Chapter 19. We put my possibly not incredibly awful stupid plan into action 2 days later. 2 days after that, the Kristang took the bait. The bait was supposedly an Elder energy trap. Through their satellites, Skippy showed the scavengers a tantalizing view of an energy tap lying on the floor of a narrow canyon. Our cover story was that the artifact had been exposed by a convenient landslide. The landslide was real. The energy tap we faked up with spare parts and discarded items. It only needed to look convincing from the top of the canyon or higher. If the scavengers were marginally competent, they would have noticed the unburied energy tap within hours of the landslide. They were completely incompetent. They didn't notice the prized energy tap lying there on the ground in the intermittent sunshine. Skippy got so frustrated he wanted to call every one of their Z-phones and ask if there was any way they could be more stupid. Thankfully, he restrained himself, and the scavengers finally noticed after Skippy practically shoved it in their faces by highlighting it in their daily sensor summary. We followed their aircraft, all the way from it being flight prepped at the scavengers' base to watching through our satellite as two pilots and 8 other Kristang loaded aboard and it took off. The aircraft was very much like the Ruhab Buzzard transport I knew from Camp Alpha in Paradise. Only this one was a little bigger and a lot uglier, and beat up. Even from high orbit, the satellite cameras showed us the patched, scratched, and dented skin of the aircraft. Skippy said the maintenance records indicated the Kristang did the absolute minimum required to keep it in the air. One of the engines was more than 1,000 hours late for an overhaul, and the pilots complained that engine always ran alarmingly hot. The other engine ran only slightly too warm and produced plenty of power, except that it vibrated so much it practically shook loose from its mounting. When the scavengers left Newark, they wouldn't be taking the aircraft with them. I could see why they didn't want to put extra resources into keeping it airworthy. And that was easy for me to say since I wasn't riding in that rattling death trap. Maybe it would fall out of the sky without us having to do anything. After it took off, Skippy followed its flight by satellite. We were able to watch it every second. The Kristang were being cautious with their beat-up aircraft. They could have come to get the fake Elder power tap the day before, but the weather had been bad, with low clouds and rain. The day the aircraft left the base, the weather was patchy clouds and cold, with only light winds. Perfect for landing a poorly maintained aircraft in an unfamiliar area. "What do we call it?" Smythe asked. While we watched the aircraft cruising along high above the clouds, it was headed straight for us. "The aircraft?" Adams inquired. On Paradise, the Ruhar had a similar vertical lift transport that we called a Buzzard. This is the Lizard version. We can call it a Luzzard for now. Or something like a Crow, maybe. "Luzzard is good enough for now," I said. I didn't want us to get distracted by a discussion that wasn't relevant to the operation. "Skippy, what are they saying?" "The pilots haven't communicated with their base since the aircraft reached cruising altitude. I can't hear them talking inside the aircraft." "Hey, I can relay their transmissions to you and translate it," Skippy offered. "That would be great. It would be useful to hear what the pilots were telling their base in real time. Relay it to the Zinger teams also." "Affirmative." We expected the Luzzard to overfly the bait, our fake Elder power tap. It made sense they would want to thoroughly check out the area. What we did not expect was for the Luzzard to fly over the area at high altitude several times and then fly in a wide circle 3 times. It was a damn good thing it had rained a lot recently. The rain covered up the fact that the area near the caverns had been well trampled by humans. We had gathered grasses and shrubs from other areas and scattered them over places where we'd walked often enough to create a path through the mud. The rain couldn't hide those tracks by itself. Except for the Zinger teams and spotters like myself, everyone else was waiting deep in the caverns with all power shut off and no artificial heat sources. We were as prepared as we could be, given the circumstances. Desai, who was with me, told me the pilot likely circling the area to look for a low-risk place to land. The Luzzard was flying slowly, cruising around, and it was a tempting target. Although it was within Zinger range, it was not comfortably within Zinger range. If the pilot detected a Zinger immediately and the missile, for any reason, missed on its first intercept attempt, the Luzzard could have flown out of range, and that would be a disaster for us. We stuck to the plan and waited for the Luzzard to descend. The Zinger teams remained undercover, maintaining discipline, waiting for Smythe's signal. Descend it did. Through Skippy, we heard the pilot call back to his base, announcing that he was making one more pass over the bait at low altitude, and that he intended to land on top of a canyon ridge rather than risk landing at the bottom of a canyon and not being able to fly back out in the aircraft he didn't completely trust. There was apparently some protest about that idea from the other Kristang aboard the Luzzard. It meant they would need to climb down the canyon, then all the way back up, lugging the precious power tap with them. The Luzzard approached from the south, with the sun behind it and not interfering with the pilot's vision. It descended rapidly at first, then went into a shallow dive. The pilot was going to fly over the canyon where the bait was located and land atop the canyon wall to the north. I gave the go signal to Smythe, and he took it from there. An Indian paratroop team got lucky, or unlucky. They were in the perfect position as the Luzzard approached. Just as the Luzzard cleared the South Canyon wall, the paratroopers rippled off a pair of missiles, and they were on the unfortunate Luzzard in the blink of an eye. Both zingers impacted the Luzzard's starboard engine nacelle, drawn in by the glaring heat signature of the straining engine. Those zingers were smart. They knew that while the engines were vulnerable and easier to target in any aircraft surrounded by a stealth field, the most vital part of the aircraft was its power center, where energy for the engines was generated and stored. That is where the zingers would normally have targeted themselves, which would have been no good for our purpose. We needed the Kristang to see a Luzzard that fell out of the sky because an engine exploded. For them to fly over the crash site and see that missiles had ripped holes in the body of the aircraft would have screwed up all our plans. That is why the Spec Ops zinger teams manually targeted the starboard engines and locked the zingers' seekers there before launch. Without a stealth field, without the pilots taking any precautions against an enemy they didn't even know was on the planet, and with the pilots flying low and slow over the canyon, searching for the bait we'd planted, the Luzzard was a sitting duck. The first missile destroyed the starboard engine. The second missile impacting a split second later obliterated what was left of the engine, plus most of the sponson it was attached to. Missile warhead debris and engine turbine blades splattered the fuselage, ripping it apart like tissue paper. The Luzzard staggered in the air, spinning rapidly to the right, its nose in the air, then it flipped over on its back and fell straight down. The tail clipped the lip of the North Canyon cliff, shearing part of the tail off, and sending the Luzzard tumbling end over end, bouncing off the canyon wall on its way down to a violent crash on the canyon floor where it rolled over several times. What was left, which was surprisingly intact, came to rest with the back half partly submerged in a stream. "Alpha Team's hold position," I ordered. Captain Joe, I knew, was itching to get into real action with his Alpha Team in powered armor suits, and I couldn't blame him one bit. The Kristang we'd seen boarding the Luzzard had been wearing typical cold weather gear, no armor and no weapons that we could see. It was possible one or two armor suits were inside the Luzzard and the Kristang had donned them in flight. That seemed unlikely. From the intel Skippy had gathered, access to the armor was restricted to the high-ranking Kristang. It was intended for them to keep their forced labor under control. Considering that, I couldn't see their leaders allowing the laborers in the Luzzard having access to any type of weapon. I also couldn't see how anyone, even genetically perfected super warriors like Kristang, could have survived the crash. The super-tough composites of the hull structure had held together, in conditions where a human-built craft would have been flaming chunks. For all their enhancements, the Kristang were biological, with the limitations of biology. The extreme G-loads of the crash must have snapped necks, crushed rib cages, torn limbs off. There was no way, I was sure, any of them could have survived that. I think I was sure. "Alpha Team, hold position," I ordered. "Repeat, hold position."
"Acknowledged," Joe replied tersely.
"Skippy, you feeding our cover story in the video?"
"Affirmative," Skippy said with uncharacteristic brevity.
A friendly beer can controlling data feeds through the Kristang's two satellites was the key to our entire plan to knock out the scavengers' advantage of air power and whittle down their numbers. What we saw on the ground was a Luzzard flying slowly over our fake Elder treasure and a pair of zingers racing up from the ground to blow up the Luzzard's starboard engine. We heard through our Z-phones the pilots shouting a warning about missiles. Then the Luzzard fell out of the sky and crashed to the bottom of the canyon. If the Kristang at their scavenger base had seen the same thing, it would have been an absolute disaster for the merry band of pirates. The Kristang would have been alerted to the presence of a hostile force on Newark. They likely would have overflown us to recon the area at high altitude with the dropship, keeping above Zinger missile range. They could have used the dropship to follow us on our march to their base, dropping off armor-suited warriors to harass us.
and they would have prepared defenses around their base so that it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for us to successfully attack. Their leaders could, likely would, even have taken the dropship with their precious Elder artifacts up into orbit or to another part of the planet that we couldn't get to by walking. And when their retrieval ship arrived, the scavengers certainly would have told the ship about an unknown hostile group on Newark, and that ship would have pounded our positions to dust from orbit. Bottom line, we needed to shoot down the Luzzard and make the Kristang think it was an accident, completely conceal our presence on the planet. Enter the magic of Skippy the Magnificent. Through his complete control of the two Kristang satellites, he was already assuring that the scavenger lizards did not see any sign of human activity on Newark. The satellites edited the image and sensor data they transmitted down to the scavengers, so they only saw what we wanted them to see. They hadn't seen our dropships making multiple trips to bring people and supplies down to Newark. They didn't see humans walking around. They didn't see the solar panels we set out. They didn't detect increased infrared radiation from the heat human activity generated. When the Kristang looked at satellite images, if they ever bothered to look at our area of the planet, all they saw was grasslands, low-growing shrubs, mud and rocks. Oh, and streams and rivers here and there. No humans. No sign that Newark was inhabited by any other sentient species. With Skippy in complete control of the audio, video, and sensor data feeds through the satellites, what the Kristang at the scavenger base saw and heard was their Luzzard hovering over a priceless Elder artifact, then the pilots shouting a warning that the starboard engine was overheating. The engine then tore itself apart, and the Luzzard crashed down. The pilot's last words would have cursed the scavenger's leaders for ignoring his warnings about neglecting engine maintenance. The video feed through the satellites did not show humans approach the wreck, with some of those humans in Kristang-powered armor. All the video feed showed was the busted Luzzard laying dead on the floor of the canyon, with no movement in or around it. And the video feed showed a priceless Elder artifact, still there, still exposed in the patchy sunlight. Still tempting. Too tempting for the scavengers to ignore. The scavenger leaders may not have cared about the Kristang who died in the crash. They may have written off the Luzzard as a cost of doing business. There was no way they were going to ignore a priceless Elder treasure that could make their entire miserable expedition pay off for them. What I was counting on was that the scavengers still had air transport, their dropship, and they would be coming for our decoy in that dropship, coming unaware their Luzzard crash had not been an accident, unaware that humans inhabited Newark. I was counting on greed, I was counting on desperation, and more importantly, I was counting on Kristang being Kristang. When their starship arrived to retrieve them, if that ship detected the Elder artifact still sitting exposed in the open, far from the scavenger base, the captain of that ship would be strongly tempted to land in his own dropship and take the artifact for himself. No way would the scavenger leaders risk that. They were coming again for our decoy. Of that, I was certain. After 10 minutes with no movement from the crashed Luzzard, I gave Smite the go-ahead signal to send in the Alpha teams. Two Chinese were closest. When they got the signal, they popped up from the covered hole they'd been concealed in and quickly raced across the muddy grass to the crashed Luzzard. Those two soldiers had way more discipline than I could have managed under the circumstances. In powered armor, I would have rocketed out of that hole 30 feet in the air and leaped halfway to the target in a single bound. These soldiers used the advantage of their suit's power in a controlled fashion, sticking close to the ground, rifles always fixed securely on the back ramp of the Luzzard. The rear door had popped open in the crash. The force of the impact wrenched the top of the ramp loose from its latching mechanism. One of the soldiers held a Z-phone up to the gap so we could get a view inside the Luzzard, while the other soldier covered him.
"I don't see anything moving in there," Zhou declared.
"Agree," Smythe said. "Wait for the French Alpha team. Then we go in."
The two French soldiers in powered armor, who had been concealed a half kilometer down the canyon, were almost at the crash site, approaching from the front of the Luzzard. Through the feed from the Z-phone network, we could all see inside the busted ship. It was chaos in there. The Kristang had exercised poor discipline in securing items inside their ship. The crash had caused all kinds of equipment to break loose and fly around inside the cargo compartment. The occupants may have been in more danger from their own gear than from falling 200 meters straight down. Whatever caused the damage, they appeared to all be dead. There wasn't anything moving inside the main compartment of the Luzzard. Two lizard bodies were visible in the narrow view provided by the Z-phone. Their legs were at awkward angles, and dark red blood was seeping onto the floor. When the French arrived, one of them slung his rifle and jumped easily up on top of the lizard near the front, then lay down and crept forward to peer in the cockpit windows.
"They're both dead up here," he said, holding a Z-phone so we could all see the carnage.
I recognized the voice. It was René Giraud. And if I had been paying attention, there was an icon at the bottom of my Z-phone screen telling me the view I was watching was from Giraud, R., French. The Cristang were hateful lizards, but they made good phones. Especially after Skippy replaced the original software with something of his own creation.
"They must have been hit by shrapnel from the warheads," Giraud reported. "The windows have holes in them. The cockpit is shredded. It's ugly," he said softly.
"Should we check inside, sir?" Smythe asked.
"Yes, if we can get the back ramp or a side door open. I don't want to cause any damage that doesn't look like it was caused by the crash," I said. "We need to maintain our cover story as much as possible." The side door had a recessed handle, with instructions written in Cristang that Skippy had the visors on the suits translate for the Alpha team. It was simple. In case of emergency, the door was supposed to be easy for rescuers to open, just like a human aircraft. One of the Chinese got the side door open easily and panned his Z-phone around. There was still nothing moving in there. Because the armor suits were bulky, the four Alpha team members waited for the Indian team without suits to arrive from up the canyon. The four Indian paratroopers quickly entered the Luzzard, and within 30 seconds reported that the Cristang inside were all dead.
"Understood," I said. "All teams pull back, cover our tracks."
That was the signal for the Alpha teams, weighed down with armor, to leave the area first, and for the people not wearing armor to sweep the embedded footprints and cover deep, muddy footprints with grass we'd collected from other areas. When they were done, it was hard to tell anyone had been there, and as heavy rain was expected that night, all signs would be securely washed away by morning. I called that a success. Phase one, complete. When I'd explained my Phase 2 plan to deal with the Scavengers' second aircraft, a dropship, and destroy the Scavengers' remaining air power, Smythe had not been enthusiastic.
"No good," Smythe had said, pointing at the map. "Too many possible landing sites for us to cover. We only have 6 Zingers left."
"Captain," I asked, "tell me, where would you land that dropship?"
"Well, that's the problem. I'd touch down here." He indicated a spot far to the east of the site where we had placed the fake Elder power tap. "Or here, or here, or here. Touchdown, drop off a 3-man team in armored suits, then drop off another 3-man team in armor somewhere over here, to the west of the crash site. Then the dropship would fly high cover out of Zinger range, while their 2 teams approached the target from opposite directions."
I nodded. "That's what I would do also. That's not what these Cristang will do. Dr. Mesker, could you come here, please?"
Certainly. What is it, Mr. Bishop?"
Mesker didn't get the nuances of military rank structure. I pointed to the crash site on the map. "This is the decoy landslide site. You familiar with the area? We put our bait there, the fake Elder power tap. It's in that canyon behind the cathedral complex."
"Yeah, sure, I've been there. That's a steep canyon."
"Right." I tapped the crash site on the map. "If you were flying in to examine the decoy site, where would you land?" He tapped the map to bring up a satellite picture overlay, then back to the map.
"Here. The canyon widens out, and the floor is big enough to land on this side of the stream. Plus, it's an easy walk up to the crash site. Except you'd need to cross the stream here. It hugs the canyon wall."
I smiled. "Thank you, Dr. Mesker."
"Captain Smythe, that's how a civilian thinks, and that's how the Cristang here think also. These scavengers are civilians, they're not soldiers. You're used to planning to counter a military opponent. Remember, these particular Cristang have no reason to think the Luzzard crash was anything but an accident. They think they're alone on this planet. They're going to land that dropship as close as possible to reduce the distance they have to walk to our decoy and the distance they have to carry anything they salvage from the crash."
"Mesker is right. They're going to land on the canyon floor somewhere, likely further down than he said, because their pilot doesn't want to take any risks with their 1 remaining aircraft. He'll want a clear path for a takeoff if he's fully loaded on the return. Somewhere in this area, I pointed near where that canyon opened into a broad, shallow canyon. Your Zinger teams can take position above the canyon here, and here, and on the canyon floor here. That dropship will likely overfly the crash site before selecting a spot for landing. You can hit him as he's over the canyon. Minimize the pilot's reaction time. Captain Smythe thought for a moment, then nodded.
What do you think? I asked. Two Zinger teams on the canyon floor covering the best land in sight, and one team on each side of the top of the canyon?
Two on the canyon floor, yes. I'll want them able to cover each other. One on top of the canyon wall, as you said, the south side. And I also want one team up here, on this hilltop. A team up there can cover the whole area. The hilltop doesn't give the best angle for a shot. We'll keep that Zinger team in reserve in case things go very sideways.
I, of course, approved the Spec Ops team leader's plan because he knew a lot more about clandestine operations than I did. To my surprise, when the dropship arrived, Smythe wanted me atop the hillside instead of watching the action from inside the cave. Of all the people on Newark, Smythe explained, I was the only one who had fired a Zinger in combat. The Spec Ops troops had trained with a simulator aboard the Dutchman, but they all had much more extensive experience with whichever model of manned portable air defense missile their country's military used on Earth. Smythe was concerned that in the tension of combat, Zinger teams would be subconsciously thinking in terms of the manpad missiles they were familiar with on Earth and not the much more capable Zingers on their shoulders. He wanted me essentially acting as a spotter on the hilltop for the primary Zinger teams below on the canyon floor. That was much better than what I expected him to want me to do, which was to sit in the cave and watch the action on an iPad or Z-phone screen. He even went so far to suggest that if the hilltop team, our reserves in case things went squirrely, needed to shoot at the dropship, I personally should fire the missile.
You have experience shooting a Zinger, sir, Smythe explained. Your report from Paradise says you got off a snapshot at a chicken that was unaware of you and about to shoot back. That's one less variable to worry about if we truly need it.
I appreciate your confidence, Captain. I will be on the hilltop, while Smythe was on the valley floor where we expected the dropship to land. There shouldn't be anything to be concerned about. These Zingers are extremely easy to use. I certainly hoped I was right about that. Until Smythe mentioned it, I hadn't even considered our team's lack of live fire experience with Zingers to be anything to worry about. That's where Smythe's greater experience and training showed, against my own. He considered anything that could go wrong. I'd only thought of things likely to go wrong. That was one difference with elite soldiers. They left almost nothing to chance.
Phase 2. Didn't work exactly as I expected. Again, the Kristang waited until there was clear weather over both their base and our area, a delay of 2 days. We watched the dropship being loaded, taken off, and cruising toward us. The dropship didn't bother to overfly the crash site. They must have thought they had plenty of intel from the satellites. From listening in to the dropship pilots' communications with the scavenger leaders back at the base, we knew the leaders were extremely anxious not to take any risks with their last functional aircraft. They ordered the pilot to land in an open area and to stay away from narrow canyons. Instead of overflying the Luzzard crash site, the dropship came straight in from the southwest. My services as a spotter for the Zinger teams were not needed because the dropship flew directly over a site we thought was a likely place for the Kristang to land. The British SAS had a Zinger team there. They hit the dropship as it flared to go into hover mode. The pair of Zingers streaked up in the blink of an eye and both hit the dropship's starboard engine pod. If that dropship had been at higher altitude, it might have had a chance to recover. It didn't. It flipped over and hit the ground hard, almost nose first, into a big boulder on the canyon floor. The force of the impact pancaked the front quarter of the dropship like an accordion. No way anyone inside had survived the crash. Smythe held his alpha teams, the people in armored suits, back for 10 minutes to be sure no angry Kristang came out of the wreck, and to be sure the whole thing didn't explode on us. I didn't waste any time. As soon as the dropship hit, I left the Zinger team on the hilltop and ran to the new crash site. It was downhill almost all the way. It still took me over an hour to get there. That was frustrating, because from the hilltop I'd been able to see the crash dropship, and it took me freaking forever to get to it. In defense of my fitness level, Newark's gravity had me weighing 14% more than Earth normal, and the low oxygen level had me breathing hard simply when walking around. While running relatively easily down a gentle slope, I checked in with Skippy.
Hey, Skippy, how are your Oscar-winning special effects going?
Oh, Joe, this is truly an epic Hollywood production. It has chills, thrills, shocking surprises, and pulse-pounding plot twists that leave the audience gasping. I laughed. I cried. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
Well, unless you're the scavenger Kristang here, in which case it's the feel-bad movie of the year.
Maybe the century.
Uh-huh. They buying it, then?
Hook, line, and sinker. I believe that is the correct expression.
Yes, they believe everything they see and hear through the satellite feed. There is no reason for them to doubt the data.
What the scavenger leaders saw through the manipulated satellite feed was their dropship getting shot down by a pair of zingers. Skippy hadn't edited that part at all. This time we wanted the scavengers seeing their aircraft shot down with Kristang portable anti-aircraft missiles. After the dropship hit the ground, Skippy had faked the imagery. The scavengers didn't see humans approach the scavenger's crashed dropship. Instead, they saw Kristang on the ground take the camouflage netting off a concealed dropship, then get aboard that dropship, fly over to the Elder Power Tap, pick it up, and fly into orbit. The mysterious second group of Kristang, having taken the big prize, then rendezvoused with a ship in orbit, a ship that lowered its stealth field long enough to take the dropship aboard. The ship then climbed out of orbit, out to safe jump range, and when this phantom ship was on the other side of the planet from the scavenger base, it jumped away. The satellite data feed included the telltale gamma-ray burst of a starship jumping. It was all, Skippy assured us, and we hoped, very convincing. The remaining scavengers had to be hopping mad by now. Not only did they now not have any functional aircraft, they had lost the priceless Elder Power Tap, lost it to a rival, unknown group of Kristang, a group that got away cleanly and was now on its way back to civilization with an Elder artifact that was worth more than many habitable planets. The scavengers were now effectively stuck at their base with whatever less valuable Elder trinkets they'd recovered, waiting to be picked up. If that had happened to me, I would sure be hopping mad. From Skippy tapping into their communications, he reported the scavenger leaders were swearing vengeance, arguing and fighting amongst themselves, and generally expending a whole lot of energy uselessly. Phase 2, I judged, was a complete success. To avoid utter humiliation at my lack of fitness, I stopped for a minute in a stream bed near the crashed dropship, hidden from the Spec Ops team's view, and sucked in air until my pulse stopped racing. The commander showing up, collapsing on the ground and puking after what should have been an easy downhill run, was something I very much wanted to avoid. When my hands stopped shaking, I stepped out of the stream bed and jogged slowly toward the smashed dropship. 24 or more people were standing around it, rifles slung over shoulders. The guys in armor suits had their helmets off. They had gotten a side door open easily. The doorframe wasn't even warped in the crash. Kristang built their ships tough, that's for sure. There were 4 Kristang bodies laying on the wet grass outside their crashed ship. 3 of the bodies were broken and mangled. 1 appeared to merely be asleep. I looked away, uncomfortable that these Kristang had died because of a sneak attack on my orders. Captain Smythe saw me coming and saluted.
Colonel, you need to see this. We have a surprise. We're clear here. The Kristang are all dead.
When we shot down the Luzzard, I had stayed away from the crashed ship because it brought back too many bad memories. Memories of the 2 whales my team had shot down on Paradise. Memories of the chicken that the Kristang had deliberately crashed there because the human pilot refused to fire a missile at a school full of children. I had those memories inside my head. They haunted me every day. I didn't need a reminder. That's why I had remained away from the crashed Luzzard. Now, I couldn't avoid seeing the dropship we had shot down, and Smythe expected me to go inside it. Steeling myself inwardly, I nodded silently to Smythe and grabbed the doorframe with 2 hands to pull myself up and into the dropship. Inside was less of a shambles than I expected. There was some blood, and debris had been thrown around in the violence of the crash. When I turned to look toward the rear, I got a surprise.
"What in the hell is this?" I asked.
The back 2/3 of the dropship were stuffed with some sort of thing. It looked like a big, rounded RV, a long tube, specially designed to fit into a dropship. It barely cleared the walls and ceiling. Straps held it securely in place.
"We think it's a vehicle of some kind, sort of a caravan," Smythe explained. "What you Americans call a recreational vehicle."
Why in the hell had the Kristang brought an RV with them to Newark? We hadn't seen them loading the RV into the dropship at the base. It must have already been on the ship. It seemed like an awful lot of weight to carry, unless they really needed it. Or maybe they did really need it. An RV would be useful for driving up the canyon to recover items from the Luzzard crash site and to get the precious Elder power tap. For use on Newark, the RV would need to be capable of operating over very rough, unimproved terrain. From satellite images, we hadn't seen evidence that the Kristang had built roads anywhere, not even around the widely scattered Elder Starship crash site. Although having an RV would have been a great help in exploring rather than walking, or having to fly everywhere. How does it move? I don't see any wheels. Skippy sighed into my Z-phone earpiece. So impatient, you monkey. You can't see the treads because they're retracted to fit inside the dropship. You will need to get the dropship mostly upright, remove the cargo straps from the RV and lower the rear ramp. Then I'll get it started and drive it out for you. The dropship was huge, almost the size of a 737 airliner. It was laying on its side. How are we supposed to get it upright? This thing must weigh a couple tons. It does. You can rig up cables, and I really shouldn't have to remind you dum-dums you have powered armor suits with you, duh. Duh was right. I hadn't thought about the armor. Powered armor did help. We needed to tell people to go slowly and be careful, as they almost used too much force and flipped the dropship over on its other side instead of on its bottom. We gave the dropship a good 10 minutes to settle on its bottom. I didn't want to risk anyone going inside until we were sure its structure wasn't going to collapse on us. When I gave the go-ahead, two soldiers went in the side door, and after a few minutes the rear ramp cracked open, lowered about halfway, and then got jammed in that position. It was amazing the thing worked at all, I suppose. After screwing with it for almost an hour, after which it was still stuck two-thirds closed, we gave up and cut through the lift mechanisms on each side. With the supports cut through, the ramp crashed down and bounced on the ground, bent a bit, but functional. Next, the team released the straps and latches that held the RV in place. Once freed, it shifted to slide against the port side of the dropship. All right, Skippy, let's see you drive that RV out of there. There was a whining sound of electric motors. Skippy had to wiggle it, with a lot of scraping and some tearing sounds, as it slowly extracted itself from the dropship's distorted fuselage. The RV was surprisingly intact. Dents and scrapes here and there. Nothing that prevented it from running properly. Out of the dropship, we could see its true size. It was as big as a city bus, or a really large RV. What it ran on was interesting. It had wheels, but wheels made of treads like a tank. The treads could be adjusted to be round for speed over good terrain, or oval-shaped for crawling along like a tractor. Skippy said the part of the treads that stuck out for traction could be retracted or extended for use in thick mud. Along each side were inflatable pontoons, so the RV could cross rivers, swamps, or even lakes. There were water jets built into each pontoon for propulsion and water. Damn, Skippy, this is a hell of a vehicle, I had to admit. Everything you need for a fun-filled family vacation, Colonel Joe. Yeah, except for a couple sullen teenagers and a solid week of rain. And bugs. That's what I recall of many fun-filled vacations in my family. Any chance we can drive this thing all the way to the scavenger's base? Unfortunately, no. The power cells only hold enough charge to get you about 40% of the way there. Crap. Ah, hey, that's 40% of the way that we don't have to walk. Hey, pop the door open, will you? I want to see inside. We were all eager to see inside our new RV. I went in last to give everyone a good look at our prize. It was well-worn and smelled funky. There were no frills on the inside. Two seats up front, then a dozen more seats that converted into bunk beds. No kitchen or other provision for cooking. No bathroom. I suppose the Kristang expected their crew to take care of those activities outside. In the back was a large, separate bay for cargo, sort of a garage. It was empty. Rubbing my chin while looking around the Spartan RV interior, I asked, "We can fit, what, 12, 14 people in here?" Smythe shook his head. I took that to mean no Special Forces soldier would think that way. "To hit that base against Kristang, maybe against 6 sets of powered armor, we need numbers. 2 people will be up front driving and navigating.
We can fit 20 passengers back here. Rig up extra seats. I figure we'll be driving through the nights until this thing runs out of power. Another 2 people, we can rig up seats in the cargo bay. We won't be bringing enough gear along to fill it. There's a cargo rack on the roof. We can set up a tent or some kind of awning up there for protection against bad weather. We can fit another 4 people. That gives us 28. In this terrain, we won't be driving fast. We might be able to have more guys running alongside it in shifts. No, I shook my head. Last thing we need is somebody spraining an ankle along the way. I don't want any driving at night, either. Too risky. 28, huh? That evens the odds somewhat. The more people we bring, the more supplies we need to take with us. That is a problem. We can look at some people going only part of the way as pack mules, carrying weapons, so people going into the fight only need to carry their weapons part of the way. This is a logistics problem, sir. We need to think about this. Having an RV does solve a whole lot of problems.